And going.
Hey folks, thanks for tuning into the Banff Podcast. I'm your hoax. I am your hoax,
Greg Lafferty.
I'm a hoax. I'm just like the Obama wiretap. I'm a hoax. I am your host, Mike Lafferty. And today we are talking about stories we would like to see made into movies. So we've got, I guess we could call this the usual panel. H. Smith, Chuck Rice, Jason Toundreau, and Chris McLaughlin, as well as my able-bodied co-host, Walter Billiard. Hi, everybody.
Hey.
Hello.
So I guess I've been thinking about this all day, and I was having trouble narrowing it down to one particular comic story I'd love to see made into a movie. Yeah. There's a couple that come to mind, but I used to, back in the day, say I really wanted to see Watchmen as a movie. And then, no, I'm not bagging on Zack Snyder because I like that book so much, I literally couldn't bring myself to buy a ticket or even watch it on streaming because I've read that book so many times and, you know, talked about it and thought about it so much. The idea of seeing it on a screen and being the neckbeard in the audience going, oh, they got this shit wrong, or oh, they got that wrong, or oh, they missed all the nuance from this element. I just didn't want to be that guy, so I just read the book instead and skipped the movie.
Have you really never seen it, Mike?
Never, no.
You should watch the first 5 minutes.
The opening is brilliant.
Yeah, the opening credits are brilliant.
I actually like the rest of it, but the opening is fantastic.
Yeah, as soon as the movie starts, like when you see like Rorschach, just turn it off. Like, but watch the opening credits.
I thought The Watchmen was Zack Snyder's good movie. I mean, that's the one you should watch, right?
Well, Sucker Punch, right?
Yeah, it's certainly...
No, not definitely not Sucker Punch.
Sorry, I love Sucker Punch as well, so I'm going to just stand up for both.
I like Watchmen. It's not the comic, obviously. But that doesn't mean that it's bad necessarily. This is where Aid and I go to fisticuffs. Aid's always been, correct me if I'm wrong here, Aid, but you've always sort of been in the, like, if I want it to be just like the comic, and if it's not like the comic, I'm not going to like it.
Well, yeah, I'll come to that. The Watchmen movie, I kind of do like because it is very similar to the comic. But then, funny enough, the entire point of when Mike said we were going to do a podcast about what movies you'd like to see made out of stories, my answer would be none at all. I don't want to see none. I want to see original stuff. I don't want to see stuff that shot-for-shot remakes. And The Watchmen is very, very good for being, that scene from the book. It's that scene from the book. But once you've seen that in 300, which is also another shot-for-shot thing of stuff, you kind of think, okay, we've done that now. Let's do a new story. Yeah. So it's like the Justice League and the Batman TV series. They managed to do, 100 episodes of Batman Animated and not really do... Hey, we're doing Dark Knight Returns this week, and this week we're doing The Killing Joke, and this week they did stories that were new and unique rather than just rehashing the same thing over and over and over again.
Yes.
Yeah, so, you make a good point. I went and picked up the animated The Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
And I turned it off halfway into it because it was it was literally like reading the book, but in animated form.
Exactly. The Killing Joke. I've watched that, but I've only watched the first 40 minutes, which is the Batgirl stuff, before the actual graphic novel starts, because I know exactly what's going to happen. And I just was not engaged with it. Whereas the Justice League Dark and the Teen Titans ones, which are, as far as I'm aware, pretty much unique stories, they were really good to watch because I had no idea where the story was going. Right. None at all.
Yeah. But I had the similar experience with the Sin City movie.
That is true as well, yes.
Which was so close to the comic. I felt like I was, like, I knew exactly, not only what was going to happen, I knew what it was going to look like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it depends what you're after. If you're after then again, if you're doing a shot-for-shot remake of the original comic books, then you're talking about the old 30s and 40s Marvel cartoons that came out that were literally just panels from the comic books. So if you're going to do that, why bother? So.
Yeah, but whatever, those were awesome.
Well, yeah. In their own way.
Well, and you can get, I mean, even with the best intentions, you can get an adaptation wrong sometime. One of my favorite writers is Ray Bradbury. And someone did, oh, God, what's that one that they made a movie of in the 80s? By the Pricking of My Something Evil This Way Comes.
Something Wicked
This Way Comes, sorry. And a theater here in town about 10 years ago contacted Bradbury when he was still alive, got him to cooperate on the production, got notes from him on all the scenes, had him do some of the, you know, introductory, you know, dialogue or monologue. You know, they recorded it, and boy, it still didn't feel like the book at all. And it just, it wasn't particularly entertaining. And, you know, it was a Halloween performance, and, you know, afterwards I've had, you know, the director and actors came out to the lobby and we're all having drinks, and there's one actor I knew from seeing around town, and we're talking about the play, and, you know, there's that awkward moment at a party sometimes where you both had two or three drinks, and you just look at the person you're talking to, say something really true and awkward, and it happened. I was like, so this wasn't a very good play, was it? And he looked at me and said, yeah, you're right, it wasn't.
Wow.
But, you know, they had all the best intentions, went to all the expense, worked with the author as much as they could, given time constraints and his health. Yeah. And they still kind of missed the dark. I mean, so I guess that's the threat you run with any kind of artistic endeavor. Well, so you might fall short.
We started off with a question of what story should we want to see adapted. And we've come instead to asking, should we adapt comic stories into films at all?
And with that, we go to Chris McLaughlin. Chris.
Well, you know, I just following up on something that Aide said, you know, I just flashed back about a decade ago, back when it really, 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 you could make a solid argument that DC films were just going to hand it to Marvel, because up to that point, Marvel had given us the Man-Thing movie. They didn't even release to theaters because it was so terrible, and the Ben Affleck Batman, and we were all making fun of Marvel because they actually thought people would go to pay see a Ben Affleck movie that he was starring in and not directing. And, you know, and it looked like DC was going to be the place where they were going to hand their properties over to serious filmmakers that would make great films that just happen to have superheroes in them, like, you know, Dark Knight.
Yeah.
And then after the Dark Knight trilogy did its thing, somehow their next move was, let's give it to Zack Snyder.
Well, to be fair, there was the Superman Returns, the Bryan Singer, which, I mean, they did try it, but apparently that wasn't a big enough success for them. Yeah. So then they handed it to Zack Snyder.
Yeah, see, that the Superman Returns was unique. To see the Batman.
Well, yeah, but I'm still trying to connect the Christopher Nolan to Zack Snyder.
Yes.
You know, to me, that's like, we can't get Orson Welles. Get me Ed Wood on the phone.
Yeah.
Well, no, the Zack Snyder thing comes from 300 to Sucker Punch to Watchmen. I mean, before he ruined Superman, he was the guy doing the thing, right? He was actually doing the comics.
That's a valid point. I see the dollar connection to it. Yes. But, you know,
faithful adaptations.
But after a couple of these, I'm back to the, you get paid to make the donuts. You keep fucking up the donuts. Why are you still allowed to make the donuts?
Yeah,
because they own the donuts.
those movies have made tons of, those donuts sell tons of dollars,
but far less than they should.
But they own the donuts, so no one gets to tell them how to make the donuts. If they want to put, you know, I don't know, garlic on their donuts, they can.
If somebody owns a Renoir and they want to use it to wipe their rear end in their front yard, that's technically their right to do so as owner. But that doesn't make it right or something I'm going to support or something that I'm just going to go, oh, well, he owns it.
Sure, but again, I think the Zack Snyder makes sense right up until the point where you see Man of Steel, right? Because he had done 300, which is a faithful representation of a comic. You can say what you want about 300, but it is the comic. And then he did Watchmen, which again is the comic. The only way Watchmen could have been more the comic would have been if the movie was Alan Moore reading it to us.
Watchmen is not, the movie is not the comic. They got everything right except the two fundamental things. Half the cast can't fucking act, and they missed the fundamental point of the story. I mean, it's like they work so hard to get all these little insane details correct and completely fundamentally miss the whole point of the story.
Now, we've talked about this before, Chris, but for those who have not listened, tell us what you mean by the fundamental point of the story.
Well, to me, Alan Moore is one of the things, the many things that Alan Moore is attempting to do is to give us a realistic portrayal of superheroes. How it would be a lot less fun and a lot less glamorous than we think. And or as it's typically portrayed, and the movie lost me in a lot of different places, but I was at a full blown fury when they get to the scene where they have the fight in the alley.
Yes.
Now in the comic, that, I mean, it's this ugly, brutal fight where this fat middle aged guy is beating on these street punks. He's not much better shape than he is. He's out of breath. And at the end, we're just supposed to be shocked by how pathetic his fight efforts is, how brutal the violence is, and how sad it is that this is what makes him feel alive.
Right.
Well, Zack Snyder gets a hold of that scene and treats it like he's making a fucking Jackie Chan movie. Yeah. I mean, the scene that's supposed to be all about de-glamorizing the violence is about glamorizing the violence.
Yes.
That got me. And when they got to the flashback scene where Dr. Manhattan's old lover accuses him of giving her cancer, never having seen the movie before, I just said, I bet he goes slow-mo and zoom in on the earrings when she ring when she throws it at him. And then it happened. And I'm surprised I'm still not in my friend's floor, still laughing. I laughed for a good 30 minutes at having called that.
Now, rewinding a little bit, you made this shift from Chris Nolan to Zack Snyder to make a point about adaptation.
Yes.
Did we get to it, or did we all get too busy jumping on Watchmen?
The interesting thing, so the Snyder thing, what we're kind of the conclusion we can kind of draw with that is Zack Snyder is the equivalent of an Inca. He can trace other people's stuff, but he can't make his own stuff. You can let him do the stuff that, Watchmen looks like the Watchmen, yeah. 300 looks like 300. Sin City looks like Sin City. Here's a film. Make your own look for it. Oh, shit, I've made it all completely all over the bloody place. So maybe that's the problem.
Well, you know that was a fair analogy until we had Batman versus Superman and Civil War come out back to back, and then after Zack Snyder's quote about how, you know, his ideal Batman movie is Batman getting raped in prison, I think he's less of an inker than just a guy that's in a cell somewhere and he's drawing on the wall in his own feces and he thinks he's doing a masterpiece.
Zack Snyder is a 12-year-old that has been allowed to make movies. That's what he is.
Do you guys not like Zack Snyder?
And so, you know what that makes him, in my opinion, being a 12-year-old that's been allowed to make movies, it makes him the perfect guy to convert material written by Frank Miller and Alan Moore. So there you go.
I'll give you later more, but 95%, I think you just nailed it, my friend.
Now, going back to what you were talking about on how Watchmen is supposed to show the failing of what a superhero endeavor would look like and how brutal and in some cases how destructive it is. Is that what really attracts you to Bendis's powers? Especially you've gone on record before as saying you really enjoyed the show.
I came in backwards. I came into the show and then went to the comics. Yeah. And without ruining for anybody who hasn't read it, I think the comics get increasingly just more and more outlandishly terrible. I think by the end of the Power series, I feel like I'm like a 4-year-old is telling me an excuse story. You know, by the end, I'm being like, and then Bigfoot showed up, and that's why there's no more ice cream. But like the TV series, I thought was I haven't seen season two yet, admittedly, but I thought season one was brilliant for the choices they made and the way they carried off most of it. And honestly, is a thing I got from my wife, because there are three things that my wife loves in this world, other than hopefully me and dogs. She loves forensic science and crime scene investigation. She loves Eddie Izzard. She loves Charlto Copley. So yeah, no. I mean, I had to get that for her.
We had a card game day last month. We played Sentinels of the Multiverse, and we had the Death Investigator for Denver County was the date of my friend. And wow, she did not dig card games, but that was the most interesting conversation I've had in months.
I bet.
You know, part that stuck with me, they get a fair amount of transients or people who just die, get brought into the county morgue, and there's no funds in the family to pay for a funeral.
Oh.
So she says a big part of her job, she makes a point to try and motivate the families to find a way to pay for Uncle Bob to go to the graveyard or to get cremated or whatever. Wow. Yeah, she'll tell them about, you know, GoFundMe, Kickstarter, you know, whatever she can to try, you know, because once the state gets your body, it's, you know, you're going to a medical school. They're going to slice and dice and, you know, get your component parts for various research things. So, yeah, and anyway, complete tangent.
We went to that from Zack Snyder movies. We're in a dark, dark place.
I'm sorry. Adaptations. Let me put this question out to you guys. Green Lantern movies. Now, I wouldn't say, I mean, there have been a lot of Green Lantern comics, arguably, in the last couple of years since they tried to make it a big franchise.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because that was going to be my choice for adapted material.
Were you going to do Hard Traveling Heroes?
Well, no. Here's the paradox that I can't solve, okay? I think that Blackest Night would make a fabulous movie. I mean, you would obviously have to scale it down some, but I think the core of that story would be absolutely fantastic. But the problem is, you couldn't make that the first Green Lantern movie.
Nobody
seems to have a clue how to make that first good Green Lantern movie.
You know what that kind of reminds me of? Like when Kevin Smith talks about the Superman script that he wrote that they'll never film.
Yeah.
He had like everything in there. Like he did the funeral for a friend scene and the entire Justice League shows up and like he was throwing everything in there because, you know, it was the only Superman script he was ever going to get to write. So why not throw everything? And Blackest Night would be like that, right? It would kind of be like the Infinity War conclusion of a multi-part film epic, right?
Well, it certainly could be, but I also think you could do a decent film with just cutting it down to the core story of having to find a way to unite all the different cores and basically doing a superhero zombie story. Yeah. And I think you could graft on as many elements from the larger universe to that as you wanted to. But I think that right there, doing a Green Lantern, essentially a Green Lantern zombie story with all the neat stuff you could do with the different cores, I think that's a solid story for a Green Lantern sequel. I just don't know how to make that first movie.
What I would like to do with Green Lantern, and not that, you know, they'll ever do this, but I would take the Green Lantern Green Arrow partnership. And I would take the high concept for High Traveling Heroes, but throw out all the specifics, right? Because Hard Traveling Heroes was very 70s. It was very much linked to its time.
And oh, yeah.
We have different.
That's the one where they're in an RV, like in a national park. Is that the story you're talking about?
That might have been part of it, but it was basically the very special episode run that Denny O'Neill did where you know, they find out Speedy is a junkie or this, you know, this next one.
The most famous scene from it is the scene Denny O'Neill writes where Green Lantern is walking around and he gets approached by this old black man who says, "Hey, I heard you've done lots of things for the orange skins and the purple skins and the blue skins, but what have you ever done for the black skins?" And it's this, and Hal Jordan sort of walks away with this horrified, ashamed expression on his face. Like he hasn't done anything for the black Americans. And this leads
other than save the planet a couple thousand times.
Yeah, exactly.
But other than that,
save Earth. Yeah.
There's I'm not saying it's not problematic, but O'Neill has said that's probably the most famous page he's ever written and ever will write. But it starts this sort of road show where Hal and Ollie and Dinah travel across America kind of experiencing all of these social issues, which were only recently allowed to be talked about because the comics code had just been softened.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of political corruption, for example, was now a legal topic that you couldn't have put in comics before that. But that would be a very different story than the very cosmic multi-core, you know, sort of Blackest Night.
Yeah. You know, why not do it like a Star Wars film where you have an opening crawl or you have somebody talking with montage scenes of Green Lanterns fighting across the cosmos, you know, or say, hey, the Justice League, you know, came.
Well, here's my thing, okay? And maybe this is just me, but anytime an opening montage crawl comes across the screen, I automatically start hearing Mike Nelson, Bill Corbett, and Kevin Murphy's voices, because it's just such a shorthand for lazy, low-budget, convoluted filmmaking that it just, it kind of lets me know this film after this, 99% is going to be a disaster.
Yeah. You would think they would probably say, well, if we're going to have multiple cores, we have to at least introduce each one of the cores in its own movie, right? So we have to do like a...
You know, no, you wouldn't, because no. I've seen what Warner Brothers is doing.
Yeah, that's true.
They didn't do that in the Lantern books, though, did they? You didn't have a Pink Lantern miniseries before the Black Knight showed up. It was just like, hey, was it Star Sapphire? And it's like, boom, okay, yes. You've seen it before. Yes. Now she's got some people with her. This is Sinestro. Yes. He's got some people with him. Yeah. This is Larfies. He's got some people with him. You didn't need to kind of worry about it.
I'm sorry, though. If I'm going to pick my pie-in-the-sky cosmic superhero story to do, it's going to be the Korvac saga.
Oh, wow.
Hell yeah, the Korvac saga. Yeah.
The reason why I say that is because I have a long-standing love for Korvac as the most ridiculous supervillain in comics. but they've got so close to doing the Korvac saga in the Guardians of the Galaxy movies when we got the Collector, and even his daughter Karina shows up very briefly just to get murdered, and that was a very important character in the Korvac saga. That's Korvac's sort of girlfriend.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, they did an episode of the Mighty Avengers cartoon, the good one, not the shitty one. They brought in all the Marvel comic heroes they could, and Michael Korvac was the heavy in that episode. Granted, it was 20 minutes, so they didn't, like, you know, it wasn't a saga, but
yeah. You know the funny thing about shooting the Korvac saga, you know, like 15 years ago, we would be saying, oh, you know, the budget's too high, and you'd have all these characters. You know, it's funny that now, 15 years later, the only part of it that does not seem doable is I just can't see that ending flying with a modern cinematic audience. And to me, that's the thing that makes it worth reading, is that ending is like nothing you ever see in any other comic series ever.
When he kills everyone. Is that what you mean? The ending where he kills everyone?
No, that's like every issue of What If ever published. Sure. Or, you know, every Elseworld ever published. It's, you know, they get into that, you know, the heroes win, and it's and they're all bummed out about it. I'm trying not to. Why am I working so hard not to spoil this 40-year-old story?
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing, actually. Hey, guys, Duncan Titanic, spoiler alert, the ship sinks.
Well, the reason why I like the Korvac saga is because it's incredibly goofy moments. Like the moment when the Avengers can't take a Quinjet because they've been grounded. Their flight license. And so they have to go find Korvac by commandeering a city bus and driving it through the suburbs until they get to Korvac's house in, like, you know, this upper white middle class suburb. With like old guys watering their lawn, and all the Avengers climb out of the bus and go into this guy's house.
That's why 70s Marvel comics will always be my favorite era, when the superheroes are falling apart just like everything else in New York City.
Yeah, sounds like Venture Brothers.
You have to put Falcon on the team because you need diversity, and Henry Peter Gyrick is in charge.
Oh, that sequence! I will never forget that page. When
the close up on Hawkeye and Falcon, and Hawkeye goes, "What the fuck did you just say?"
They're reading out the names of everybody who's allowed in the Avengers, and they see each person, and every one of them is like showing a happy face, you know. And Ms. Marvel gets on because, you know, it was totally diversity issue. And then the last panel, he says, "And Falcon," and it's not a picture of Falcon; it's a picture of Hawkeye saying,
"Yeah,
what?"
Which is great for so many reasons. One of which is it's always great to take a huge dump on Hawkeye any chance you get. Because everyone knows the only reason Hawkeye is in the Avengers is to make Thor look really good. But then the other thing that's great about it is then they turn to Falcon and he's like, "No, get out. I'm not your token. Get out."
But he does join the team.
Cap talks him into it.
Because and then he walks out like 5 issues later and nobody notices he's gone. That's the genius. Yeah. It's great.
Although the only answer to the question, in my opinion, on adaptions is Demon in a Bottle. I want to see Robert Downey Jr. do Demon in a Bottle. If they were actually willing to do it, just tell Robert Downey Jr., you're an Oscar-nominated actor. Cut loose. You know a thing or two about addiction. It's sort of going to be a superhero movie, but sort of not. And then you just get to ride off into the sunset and you never have to play Iron Man again. I think he would be so happy.
No, I think Iron Man 2 might be the closest we ever get to that.
Yeah.
Because if that's the closest we're ever getting to that, then that's not close enough.
Yeah.
But that's the problem. They don't like showing hero characters with too many negative traits.
Yes, although the brilliant thing about Johnny's performance is that you can totally tell that he's an alcoholic and he's drunk about half the time when he plays Iron Man.
70s Marvel was all about the characters with the kind of like the negative traits, and nowadays it's like, okay, you can be a bit of a jerk, but that's probably about as far as we're willing to go. You can't be, you know.
Yeah, it's
an alcoholic or whatever, or you know, it's very difficult for him to do that, because again, then you're just glorifying drinking, so therefore that would be, that's that off the table straight away. So
I think Arya Vrad was talking about this recently. People were criticizing the Marvel films because their villains are not as interesting as the heroes are, and he said you're right. He said he was watching one of the films and he said, and I realized that we are the company that focuses on the heroes and the villains are not as three-dimensional. They're not as fully fleshed out. They're just not as interesting as the heroes are. He says, but you know what? I'm okay with that. I'd rather be that than the alternative. By which he meant DC, right? Where,
yeah. There's
a commercial aspect to that too, because if you think about like the absolute most memorable Marvel villains, Fox owns Dr. Doom and Magneto.
Yep.
And up until recently, Sony had the Green Goblin.
Yeah.
And they killed the Red Skull for some insane reason.
Well, they were afraid of the Red Skull. Like, for example, they're not,
he's
not a Nazi. I mean, for example, that shows you how terrified they were of the Red Skull.
Yeah, he out-Nazi.
If anyone should get to be a Nazi,
you're too crazy.
Yeah. If anyone should get to be a Nazi, it should be the guy with a skull head. Come on.
Well, you know, you get merchandising rights in Germany to think about, and it gets complicated there. But changing subjects, I'm going to suggest that the best way to make an introductory Green Lantern movie, try to set up the whole institution of the Green Lanterns, is to do an Ebon Sur film, where he's in deep space having adventures, and then last 15 minutes he dies on Earth and gives the ring to Hal Jordan, and then... You know, Green Lantern 2 is...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say Green Lantern 2 is someone who is not Ryan Reynolds, you know.
Well, and
well, you know, I actually had a thought about how you could do that good first movie. And it's a rough sketch, I admit, but here it is. Okay. To me, the fundamental weakness in any Green Lantern story is the fact that Hal Jordan is... the blandest thing ever. He's like when white met bread. He's absolutely the most boring, enduring character in the entire DC universe.
Isn't being a pilot supposed to be kind of
cool? He makes that boring. He makes that seem boring.
Okay.
But here's how I think you might do it. Is I think what you might ought to have to do is to try to mix the best elements of the character going back to the 1940s. Like, give him Alan Scott's origin, but Kyle Rayner's personality.
You know,
And then if you want to call him Hal Jordan just to make Jeff Johns happy, knock yourself out.
I think
the less actual Hal Jordan you have in it, the better the story will be.
When I ask my students about Green Lantern, they all think of Jon Stewart.
Yeah. Well, yeah. More interesting than Hal.
John Stewart's the right answer. The animated John Stewart, especially.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, I think that might be a good choice if they ever go live action again. And I'm sure Will Smith would do it.
But there's still rumors that we are going to get a Green Lantern show up in the Justice League movie as either end of sequence thing or something like that. Because and John Stewart is the name that's been attached to that. So whether or not that happens, who knows? But
Jeff Johns has any say over it, it will be Hal Jordan blanding it up all over the screen.
You know, somewhere Idris Elba's cell phone is ringing. I just said,
what's that like?
They should cast Idris Elba for that.
Yeah, it'd be brilliant.
I was just going to say that. That was
is a great,
awesome.
Cross the great stream guy. Like yeah.
that? Say what?
Is that allowed? Can you cross the streams like that? Is that allowed?
Well, I think his character dies in Ragnarok, right? Like they've been hinting that Heimdall might bite it in Ragnarok. So.
Oh, yeah, it's Heimdall, isn't it? Yeah.
I think that would make Idris Elba the king of all nerdery because he's been in a Star Trek movie. He's
still in Christopher Lee's shadow.
Yeah.
Well, okay, sure. Yeah.
But we all are. So, you know.
He'll always be Stringer Bell to me.
And if you want a bonus thing, I actually thought of the superhero comic cut property that I thought would be best suited for a Netflix series, if you want to go there.
Which is?
Sandman Mystery Theater.
Oh, yeah. That'd be a great show. Yeah.
Because you could do it on a reasonable budget. You have so many it's an era that hasn't been done before. There's so many elements you could play with since it's set in the or late 30s, because you've got, you know, the beginning of worldwide fascism. You still got gangsters. You still got the Depression. You still have race, sex, culture issues that you can play with. And if things get slow, you can always start to weave the Justice Society into it.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
I would love to see a more period piece version of superheroes. I really loved Peggy Agent Carter when that was on.
Oh yeah.
And when she walked into the Automat and they had, you know, the Automat was a regular set on the show. They had me.
Season one was pretty great. I'll give you that. I thought you were going to say Barry Windboy Genius as your dream adaptation, Chris.
You know, my wife is really into that, and I appreciate certain aspects of it, but I, you know, just, it, you know, not really my thing.
Oh, all right. Chuck, do you have a dream adaptation project?
I already went. Demon in a Bottle. That's the answer to the question. That's nope. I don't think it'll ever happen. I'm also the guy that would like to see them actually do God Loves Man Kills, where it ends with a cop shooting a televangelist. That would make me so happy in the blackest pit of my heart.
Maybe we could make it Baker and Chris could get his...
Okay, well, not being funny, wasn't X-Men 2 partially God Loves Man Kills?
Yes, but again doesn't end partially with a cop shooting a televangelist.
Little bits, yeah. Look, like,
Bryan Singer has had the best taste of X-Men stories to ruin, okay? Because they've also kind of done Dark Phoenix, kind of.
Yeah, and they're going to do it again.
But can't we hang that one on? Aren't we supposed to hang that one on Brett Ratner? Isn't that the third one?
No, because Bryan Singer decided the story was going to be that. The script was pretty much done. And seeing what he did in X2 with God Loves Man Kills, it would have been better than the Brett Ratner movie, but it wouldn't have been Dark Phoenix.
But again, this is the crazy
thing. Running the undeveloped film through this camera would have been better than a Brett Ratner film.
True. Yes.
They keep going for adaptions again and again. We're going to see Dark Phoenix again. How many times have we seen Dark Phoenix in the animated series? We've seen it in this. We've seen that. They just cannot get rid of like the 70s era. 70s era seems to be, or 70s, 80s era seems to be like the plum stuff they draw from.
Well, here's the thing. There's no excuse that the fact that the best version of the Dark Phoenix saga besides the comic is the 90s cartoon with goddamn Jubilee in it. There's no excuse for that. They have to be able to do better than that.
Wait a minute. I'm getting an idea. Okay, so 70s and 80s comics, Netflix series, Dazzler.
See, I'd watch Dazzler because I actually really like Dazzler, so that would be perfect.
Only if it was
set in the 70s.
Set it in the 70s. Do a disco superhero. Make it Dazzler, I'm telling you.
Dazzler was almost the thing. I mean, if you think about it, Claremont and Byrne were trying out a new character, and it was down to Dazzler or Kitty Pryde.
The soundtrack alone would sell like
let us not forget Dazzler came into the comics because it was going to be a movie.
Yes, that's right. They had
which sadly we never got.
They had photo covers for Dazzler, I remember.
Yeah, yeah. The first issue is definitely a photo cover, yeah.
Not getting the Dazzler movie and the Blaxploitation Silver Surfer movie, I think, are the two greatest tragic superhero movie losses.
Yeah. Tell me about the Blaxploitation Silver Surfer. I don't think I've heard this story.
We all, I think, are at least somewhat familiar with the era in the 70s when Stan Lee was no longer actually writing comics. He was just running around Hollywood, like, you know, I've always pictured him like in the back of a van, like selling the rights to Marvel properties to whoever just happened by. And at one point, he sold the option, like 74, 75, like to a producer who thought the only way that Silver Surfer would work as a movie is to do it as a blaxploitation film. And somebody, I forget who, published like a page of the script or a synopsis of it. And it literally is the Silver Surfer flies into Harlem, comes face to face with Sweet Daddy String Bean or like some like really obnoxious blaxploitation name, who pulls a gun on him and says, "Hey, Jim, you handing over that board?" And I'm just thinking, there would still be Jaws on the theater floors 40 years later that would have gotten made.
Hey, you know, we got over that Nick Fury movie. We would have gotten over the, but it would have been great. You're right.
Are you talking about the Hasselhoff Nick Fury?
Hasselhoff Nick Fury, yeah.
Yes, of course, Hasselhoff Nick Fury.
You know, yeah. if we ever do an MST 3K style podcast, we should really do Hasselhoff Nick Fury, or at least like
do all of them. No, we should watch the Corman.
We'd have to do the Doctor Strange movie. That is the most batshit crazy.
One where he
the shield is the windshield on his motorcycle.
Yeah. And the Red Skull's Italian. Don't forget that. He's descended from El Duce, right?
Can we do this, Mike?
Hey, there's no reason not to. We'll have to talk about some of the technical issues, but yeah, especially if we sync up, you know, say, all right, if you're watching this at home, press play now.
I'm only doing it if Chris comes.
That sounds like a plan.
Oh, well, we've done a lot of, and for my bi-monthly film fest, we've done a lot of bad superhero movies. And yes, I'm well acquainted with the 70s Doctor Strange and the 70s Captain America, where one of his superpowers is owning a van. Yeah, oh yeah. I'd be
By the way, both totally. Of those better than the Jennifer Garner Electra. By far.
Oh.
By far.
You've already done some of these movies, Chris, but you got to come anyway, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. So, as long as I can plug my spinoff idea.
Okay, then I'm in.
Okay. We watched the Hulk reunion movie where they try to bring Thor into the Bill Bixby Hulk universe.
Yes.
And there's a scene where he's in Donald Blake's apartment and he's like emptying out a case of Coors beer into like a pitcher and drinking it.
Yeah.
And seeing Thor hold Coors beer, of course, being raised in the 70s drive-ins of the South, made me think of Smokey and the Bandit.
Yes.
And thinking, do a movie where, like, you know, a couple of rich guys, you know, they offer the Hulk and Thor like 80 grand to get Coors beer from like Texas to Georgia in so many hours. And it's a car chase movie with the Hulk and Thor.
Well, you're getting a road trip movie with Hulk and Thor this year. I mean,
go. But they're going to hate themselves for not throwing in like the bootleg beer and the car chase.
Yeah, you're right.
And Jackie Gleason, you know?
Yeah. You know, you could do Cannonball Run as one of those big, you know, line-wide crossovers, and I actually like that idea.
Could they CGI Jackie Gleason back from the dead for this movie?
There you go. Can
we make that happen?
He's the Black Lantern.
Well, if you
do Blackest Night as a Cannonball Run mashup. It's perfect.
Well, you know, speaking of Cannonball Run, if you think about it, if they screw up some of these later Marvel movies, you could get a very Cannonball Run-like feeling. Because what were the Cannonball movies, but a bunch of celebrities just staggering on camera, like half sober for like, you know, for like a minute and a half and collecting a check for it?
Yeah.
You know, if they did a really bad later Marvel series, it could basically be that, only they're dressed up as superheroes.
Well, from what I've heard, we might be getting our first look at a bad Marvel thing, because critics do not like Iron Fist at all.
I know. But then I won't.
Yeah.
You know, I really want to watch it first. There was a lot of prejudging of Iron Fist. A lot of people saying that, well, because he's a white dude that learns kung fu, it was not racially appropriate today. And I guess I trusted the writers to deal with this in a smart way.
I can see that being an issue, but surely as a character that's, what, 40 years old, that shouldn't be a shock to anybody now. It kind of seems a bit confusing. It's like, oh, wow, it's what, dude, what?
I didn't understand the desire of people saying, well, you should change his casting. You should make him Asian. I'm like, well, then it's not Iron Fist. Then you're doing Shang-Chi. I mean, there's other characters to come.
Well, look. Let's face it. It is now. We have now developed an era where we live in an era where being outraged is a job.
Yes.
Yeah, I understand.
You can be professionally offended. And let's face it. This was just something the professionally offended were waiting for.
But I'm eager to see it, and I have read that the first six episodes, which is all anybody's seen, are really boring. But I said,
it's like Luke Cage.
The second half of Luke Cage is, I'm going to be honest with you, I did not like the second half of Luke Cage at all. I thought it started off really great, but it wasted the whole premise. And Luke does nothing but the bulletproof guy just gets shot. And he fights black on black crime all the time. And I thought it wasted everything that it could
have. The episode before the flashback, where they showed his origin, was where I started to wane and thought, right, I've had enough. I'll give it one more episode. And I actually thought that I really liked the episode. Yep. And then I got like two or three after that. And then it really started to wane. I thought, oh, okay. Right. Now there's only two left to worry about now. Let's just get it over and done with. And we'll finish that with it. But yeah, it was just, I mean, again, the flashback episode was cool because he had his original costume on, you know, virtually. It's like when he had the little headband, I thought, that's
pretty cool. I tell you the two things I'm seeing in the Iron Fist reviews that actually trouble me.
Yeah, good.
I'm hearing a lot of people saying that it's like 10 episodes of plot stretched out over 13 episodes. And to me, that sounds like every Marvel Netflix series.
Yeah,
if that's true of Iron Fist, to me, would not surprise me a bit.
Also, sounds like the last two series of Torchwood, but there you go.
It's apparently a very common problem. And then I keep seeing all these reviews talking about how there's like precious little action and martial arts.
Yes.
And to me, if that's true, granted, none of us have seen it, but if it's true, how do you make Iron Fist without crazy martial arts? Yeah. That's like, you know, you pay money to watch Kickboxer 4 and there's no kickboxing.
Yeah. Nobody expected Daredevil to have the incredible fight choreography.
True.
But when you're making Iron Fist, that's what people expect. That's what they're tuning in, is to see that.
See, Kickboxer 4 could be the movie about the bloke who takes the bets behind the counter rather than the actual kickboxers. That could be what it is.
But geez, Iron Fist with no kung fu? That's like a Punisher movie where he doesn't kill people, or a Superman movie where he does kill people. It just seems like something fundamentally wrong has happened here.
Look, man, Punisher's going to use a bow, and he's going to play head games with the bad guy, who are John Travolta, okay? Great.
I got two things to say. Number one, I think there are some comics properties that are probably best suited to the period pieces. I think, Chris, did you suggest a 1930s JSA movie?
I think that would be a great thing that you could do in a later season of my proposed Sandman Mystery Theater show.
Okay. I'm going to suggest, and maybe 1960s for Fantastic Four. maybe 1960s or 70s for Nick Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. Kind of get that sort of classic feel.
Cold War era Fury would be better than,
Yes.
Mike, I think you're onto something. I mean, how much fun would it be to see let's say hypothetically, like Marvel gets the rights to Fantastic Four back and they do an origin story, like a first movie, which is in the 60s and is full of the gee whiz, we've got to get to the moon. And then, you know, they go in the negative zone and they come out in the end and it's 2017. I know that's a steal from Captain America, but it would not bother me in the slightest.
Yeah. So the reboot rumor, before they made the last one, originally it was going to be, hey, Marvel are going to get it back. It's going to be a 1950s atomic era science fiction superhero film rather than something modern day. And it's like, oh, okay, that sounds pretty cool. And then it's like, gone. We're going to make it dark.
Hang on, guys. I got an idea to pitch to you. We're going to get the guy who did Chronicle, and he's going to do like a body horror found footage Fantastic Four movie. I'm telling you, it's going to be lights out. It's going to be awesome.
Cannot lose.
All right, but how awesome would a Nick Fury movie be that did a lot of visual nods to Jim Steranko's page designs?
Oh, wow. That would be something.
And look, we're gonna get Miles Teller and we're gonna get the guy from Turn who's awesome. And dude, I'm telling you, this movie cannot. We're gonna get the chick from House of Cards. We're gonna get Michael B. Jordan. This movie's gonna be awesome.
I mean, there is a possibility Marvel could do this because obviously Wonder Woman is World War One. If they see that going okay and they actually see, hey, we've got some era stuff here we can actually draw from, and it didn't, you know, it doesn't bomb like everything else, Marvel might go, well, we could fill our back catalog up. We could fill our backstory up for these between Captain America 1940s to the modern day stuff. Maybe that could be a potential.
I think that's what I thought they were going to do with Agent Carter, right? Which started in the 50s.
Yeah.
And it was sort of that Mad Men meets Marvel era, which I thought was so great and had so much potential.
Yeah.
But
maybe even the flashback stuff they did in Ant-Man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But we didn't really see a lot of those characters show up in Carter, which I thought was kind of a big mistake.
Well, yeah.
Season two kind of went off the rails. Hey, speaking of stories we'd like to see adapted into movies, you know one story I think someone on this podcast wants to see into movies? It's King Arthur.
He's
coming to a theater near you, May 12th, 2017, by director Guy Ritchie.
Well, Guy. So there's.
Jason, what do you think about that?
There's a ton of Arthur movies coming out right now, and Arthur stuff all over. It's not just Guy Ritchie's movie, which is probably going to be a giant, colossal train wreck. But which I will loyally go and. What was that? What was that? What?
I said, what? That never happens. Bad.
It's not going to be as good as the last one. What was the last one called King Arthur? The one that was set kind of like 4 AD or something, although which had Keira Knightley.
It's interesting that version, and I can't remember the guy who plays him.
It's Johan Grifold, right?
Yeah.
What?
Clive Owen,
that's right.
Yeah.
Owen Griffith is Lancelot. Mads Mikkelsen is Tristan. Joel Egerton is Gawain. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Are we talking about the new one or the one that...
To 2004, where Keira Knightley was Guinevere, Ray Stevenson was Dagonet.
Yeah. Well, that film is actually based on a kind of big deal in Arthurian studies. There's this guy named Geoffrey Ashe who wrote a book about King Arthur, and he did a bunch of historical research, trying to research the historical roots behind the myth. And what he did was he looked in a place nobody had looked before, and he found these historical records in France of a British sort of cavalry leader who led a group of mounted soldiers into France and fought in France and died there at about the right time. And his argument is it's called the Sarmatian hypothesis, that this Arthur guy, whose name was not Arthur, but whose name was Real Thamus. But Real Thamus was a Roman soldier, but he had been recruited from among the Sarmatians, which is this culture of horse riding, very militant culture that were serving Rome as mercenaries at the time. And he wrote books about this hypothesis, and it kind of got some traction in Arthurian scholarship. Now, the whole sort of quest for the real King Arthur is kind of a giant fool's game. You know, the Arthur that we're making movies about is not any real King Arthur. It's a legendary creation. But that film is based on Geoffrey Ashe's Sarmatian hypothesis. And then that's who Clive Owen is playing. It's Real Thamus, basically. Which is an interesting take, and so I found it interesting from that point of view. I'm not one of those guys that needs my King Arthur movies to be a faithful retelling of the original book. If I want to read the Dark Phoenix saga, I go read the Dark Phoenix saga, right? Eight is up there with me, I think, you know? So if you're going to – but on this, I think if you're going to tell an Arthur story, then, you know, do your own version of it, because there's plenty of other versions of it that I can go see if I want to watch that. You know, I'm open to creativity when it comes to this. So that's why I say I'll see Ritchie's movie with an open mind. And I don't want to judge it by the trailer, even though I can't make a thing out of the trailer. I don't know what the fuck is going on.
which may not have been the effect they were going for.
Probably not. Yeah. But there's a bunch of Arthur stuff right now. There's a television series coming out with a modern King Arthur. We just got news about that Matt Wagner has announced Mage Volume 3 at Emerald City Comic Con, so we're finally getting the conclusion to that series. which I would not be who I am today if not for Mage. My first academic work was on Mage, and that's I wrote essays that went into edited anthologies about it, and it went into my dissertation. And the fact that I could talk about Mage in an academic environment is what led me to become a professor in the first place and go back to grad school. So I think I could probably say that if you were going back in time and you wanted to ruin my life, just like shoot Matt Wagner, aww, and I would be a total different person. Yeah. But anyway, this is all Mike's attempts to sort of get me around to Arthur Lives, which is finally coming out.
What? No? What? Yeah. What's this?
So the longtime listeners of the podcast have heard this phrase before, but in 2009, we did Arthur Lives through Vigilance Press. And ooh, Chuck, who's here on this podcast, I'm so glad. So, like, Chuck, I'm going to talk all about you in the first blog entry on the Facebook page tomorrow.
Sure. Make sure you give me all the credit. Absolutely.
I am. Happily done. But I came to Chuck about, 10 years ago now. And I had this game that I had written for True 20. It used the True 20 system.
Yeah.
By Green Ronin. And it was a modern-day Arthurian reincarnations. And they're all coming back, and there's multiple versions of each character. So, like, there's more than one Arthur out there, and more than one Merlin, and everyone's getting reincarnated, and they don't really understand who they are at first, and you have to kind of discover your Arthurian identity during play, and then you have to try to solve these questions, like, why are we here, and what do we do now, and there's a lot of player agency in it. And the players encounter other incarnations who have not yet recognized themselves, and they have to figure out, well, do we want to help them or not? Maybe their life is better if they're ignorant, but we need them because you've got this valuable skill that we need for this adventure or whatever. So there's a lot of role-playing and kind of problem-solving and a lot of introspection, and of course, but there's also a lot of cinematic action because, let's face it, we're talking about Arthurian knights in the present day. And magic and stuff like that. Well, anyway, so I came to Chuck with it, and Chuck, for which I will be forever grateful, he took a gamble on it and he said, yeah, let's print it. And you found art for it, and we put it out as three separate books. We did a player's guide, a GM's book, and we did the first adventure, like an introductory adventure called The Best Knight in the World. And it's still for sale. It's still for sale on RPG Now, and people can still buy it. But the number one feedback I got on it was always the same. It was everyone who read it loved it, and they would always say, I can't wait to convert this to fill in your favorite system here, right? Whatever your favorite system is, they were going to convert it. Because 220, although it was a kind of a good match for the game at the time, nobody played it. Nobody played it. Even that game system, 220, was invented for Blue Rose. And now the new edition of Blue Rose has come out and doesn't use 220, right? So even the game
people seem to like the Dragon Age system.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing about True 20. Let me jump in on that.
Sure, yeah.
What I learned about True 20 by producing several True 20 products that no one bought, yeah, is that True 20 is brilliant, but everyone that bought True 20 bought it because it's so easy to do your own thing with it, yeah, that they're like, why would I pay you to do something? I can do what I want because, yeah, the system is so easy to adapt. So
yeah. Sadly, it was very it had a lot of gears and levers and dials, yeah, and switches on.
Basically, I'm saying Steve Kinson is too good. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's like the irony being is that Fate and Apocalypse World are the same kind of thing. Everybody uses those now.
So. Yeah. So then Chuck, you left Vigilance. You sold Vigilance Press. And the second person that kind of that I needed help with came along, and that was James Dossie. And Dossie was looking through the product catalog for Vigilance that he had bought, and I don't think he even really knew everything that he had bought when he bought it. And he sees this Arthur Lives thing on the list, and it's not Mutants and Masterminds, and it's not Icons, and like, what is it? And he calls me up, and we talk about it. And after a while, he says, well, do you want to do a new version of this? It sounds like a really great idea. What if we kind of relaunch it? And I said, well, that sounds great, but we have to find a new system. And he was totally agreed with me. But we didn't know what system to do, what system to pick. And True 20 was not the first system I had used for Arthur Lives. I've been playing this game since I was an undergrad. And I'd been through multiple different systems with it over the years, trying to find one that really fit very well. And so we gave it some time, and James gave me all the time in the world to take my time with it, and that was incredibly valuable. And then I started to hear about Fate Core, which was in playtest at that time. Fate Core had not been released. And I couldn't get an early copy of it. So I waited until the Fate Core Kickstarter came out, and I got a copy of it. And like the minute I had playtest copy in my hand, I started to write Arthur Liv's second edition for Fate, which required a complete rewrite of the entire game. Because with 220, I had all these resources that were already published. I had a bestiary of monsters that I could just say, okay, just use those guys, you know, dragons from page 20, whatever, of the 220 bestiary. And I had books for each of the different classes, and I had books of a magic system, and there were all kinds of stuff already in existence for 220. But Fate's not like that. Fate's a very game-specific, world-specific system, so you invent all that stuff. So the magic system of your game is unique to your game. And your adversaries and monsters are all unique to your setting. So, and also, none of that stuff had come out for Fate yet, because I was writing it when the game was brand new. So I had to rewrite everything, and I did, and I rewrote the whole thing, and then just in time for a Vigilance Press to put out Tianxia instead. and am I saying the name of that game right? Tianxia?
I don't know.
I think it's Tianxia.
Yeah, Tianxia. Okay. Chinese. Okay.
This is why I'll probably still like Iron Fist, even though I'm because I'm completely uneducated. But that game just exploded, and their Kickstarter went to the sky, and they made a bunch of stretch goals, and they've got all these books coming out, and there was just no room on the schedule for Arthur Liv's anymore, and so that's when I came to you, Mike, and you agreed to. We waited a while, and then James very kindly, graciously handed over all the assets to Arthur Liv's, and I brought it to you. And we waited a while for a good time, and now the Kickstarter is finally about to launch. It launches on the 2nd of April. And the book is written, manuscript is written, and the art's already started to come in. And anybody who pledges to it will get a copy of that manuscript right away. So you'll get the text. Even if the game never publishes, if we fail to meet all of our stretch goals, or even our basic goal, you'll still have a 250-page book. And you can play Arthur Liv's immediately using Fate. It's got a massive magic system, enchantment, which has like over a dozen different magical talents in it, everything from binding to weather control and necromancy and all kinds of stuff. It's got a whole bestiary full of monsters and creatures, that some of which live here on Earth, some of which come from the Fairy Vale. I've got the ubiquitous vampire menace, because the idea of King Arthur fighting vampires, I just couldn't resist. And then we've got angels and demons and rival incarnations, because some of them have already come back and they've been here longer than you and they're already prepared. You've got occult conspiracies of people that aren't related to Arthur but know that he's coming back and have their own agendas. And character creation advice and campaigning advice and a plot gallery full of adventure seeds. And I mean, it's a massive project. And it's been playtested in many cities across the country as I have myself moved from one job to another, from one grad school to employment. I've always taken the game with me and run it as I've gone. I've got lots of playtesting, and I'm playtesting it with my current gaming group here. So it's really exciting and a lot of fun. And it's funny that how this game would be coming out at a time when there's a bunch of King Arthur stuff also coming out. King Arthur kind of goes in waves, you know, he goes through trends, kind of like giant asteroids hitting the Earth movies. You know, they come in groups, and it just so happens that there's a wave coming now, which is, I guess good. I don't know, but certainly not surprising to anybody who studies Arthur.
So, you know, you're an Arthur academic. This is a passion of yours.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about adaptations on this podcast, has there ever been a good, you know, TV or movie adaptation that kind of, you know, captured the heart and essence of the myth?
I don't know. Everyone has their own favorite version, but I think we have to give some kind of props to Excalibur. You know, we have to talk about Excalibur, um, which which for many people is kind of the definitive King Arthur movie.
It's also one of the greatest movies ever made. Freaking Nicole Williamson is in that movie.
He really is brilliant. And some of his lines, some of the lines in that movie are unforgettable, you know, like it is the doom of men that they forget. And things like that. I mean, when I was an undergrad, and we could recite the entire script of that movie, like at a knob of a hat, we could do the whole movie. It hasn't aged terribly well. It has some moments that are a bit awkward, to say the least. Having sex in full plate mail being one of them. But we have to give Excalibur some huge cred. Young Helen Mirren is in that movie.
Yes, Nigel Terry. That movie has so many good actors in it.
Patrick Stewart. Yes.
You know, yeah. Liam Neeson
is in that movie.
I have a bit of trivia about that movie that you gentlemen might appreciate. Excalibur exists because for a brief time, John Borman actually had the rights to the Lord of the Rings movies.
You're shitting.
No. And befitting the guy who gave the world Zardoz.
Yes.
The only way that he could make it happen with the deal that he had made was he was going to condense all three books into one movie.
Yes.
And to make it fit budget-wise, they were going to cut out all the magical bits.
Of course they were.
Of course they were.
And I'm not a huge Lord of the Rings guy. I don't have a fantasy gene, but even I can only scarcely imagine what a travesty that would have been.
So how does that relate to Excalibur?
Eventually all that fell apart, but he had scouted all these locations in Ireland that he was preemptively going to use to shoot this Lord of the Ring travesty. And when the whole Lord of the Rings thing went away, you know, he had done all this, you know, fantasy-esque research, had all these great locations, and then he said, why not use these locations and shoot the Arthurian mythos?
It's interesting too that you should tell us that, because Excalibur, it has some weak parts as a film, but what's interesting about it is how ambitious it is, because it really does try to take the entire Arthurian saga and condense it down into mm-hmm. 1 2-hour movie. And you can see Borman's ambition from trying to take Lord of the Rings and do a similar thing.
Oh, hello.
But I can tell you the opposite. I can tell you the movie that made me go out and write my own King Arthur novel, because anybody could be better than that. and that was the Sean Connery.
Oh my God, Richard Gere. Richard fucking Gere as Lancelot. Oh my God.
That was the movie where I literally walked out of the theater at the credits saying, I can do better than that. And I went and wrote a 400-page novel.
Are you telling me that in the original Arthurian legend, there's not the Ninja Warrior style assault course? Is that not in there? Because I swear it must be in there somewhere.
See, that's not what bothers me, though. Like, when people do shit like that, that doesn't bother me. The movie was just
boring.
It was just bad. The dialogue was terrible, and the costumes were ridiculous. They looked like fucking space marines.
Neither Sean Connery nor Richard Gere can fight. That didn't help that movie. Like, they were both too old and out of shape to actually fight.
So bad.
You know, after seeing that movie, I concluded, wow, now the enduring rumor about Richard Gere and the gerbil in the emergency room is going to be only the second most embarrassing thing his name has been associated with.
Who was it? Juliette Binoche. That's the takeaway from that movie. You're like, wow, she's really beautiful. That's what you remember about that movie.
Yeah.
Fondly.
The inspiration for Arthur Lives comes from Matt Wagner's Mage, Camelot 3000.
Which is awesome.
Which is awesome. Mike Barr and Brian Boland. Which I read sitting in the aisles at Save on Drug, one issue at a time as it came out. And then, of course, Greg Stafford's Pendragon, which in terms of role-playing games, that game is a legend to me. Like, I know a lot of people have never heard of it or would never play it.
Fuck those people.
The work... Yeah, I agree. See, Chuck and I are like this. this is why he agreed to publish Arthur Lives in the first place.
Well, that I told him was a good idea.
Okay, there you go. Thank you, Mike. Pendragon is, and Stafford's knowledge of the field meant that I always had a guide. Like, if I wanted to know, well, like, can I adapt this story to gaming? Stafford had already done it, so I could look at how he did it and decide what I wanted to do. Super valuable.
Yeah.
Mike?
Hey, we need to go ahead and start wrapping things up a little bit. Walt, you've been a little quiet this podcast. Was there any adaptation you wanted to mention or dream adaptation project you wanted to mention before we call it a show?
The only thing I can think of that springs to mind is even though it would tear me apart in the theater, is We Three.
Oh my God! Oh,
wow. Yeah. Yeah.
I just read that.
That was supposed to be the film project. Like I remember distinctly reading that got optioned and that was going to be coming out.
I think though I wouldn't want to see it live action. I would want to see it animated in the same style as those Lord of the Ring cartoons.
The
Bakshi. No singing, but that watercolor esque type look.
Yeah, the Bakshi rotoscope movies. Yeah.
You know, so that to me would be the most amazing transition from comic panel to
you would cry for an hour and a half.
Oh my God. Yeah. I was tearing up when I read that, or you know, because that property's a few years old now. One that recently I would like to see turned into a movie also involving animals is the new series Animosity. If you're not reading it and you're an animal lover, the first issue, sitting in bed with my wife, reading this together, you know, both our ears stuck together, reading this comic, and the end panel, we were all like, oh my God, I'm verklempt, you know, because you were just, it was the most, you know, the whole comic is vicious all the way through. And then this last panel, you just see the love of someone in their dog, and you're just like, I am hooked for the rest of this series.
Sold,
you know, yeah, you know, just that, and the fact that, you know, seeing a panda with a machine gun and grenades is just something of beauty. So, but yeah, if you're not reading Animosity, you really should go out and check it out. It's phenomenal.
Who's it by?
I think it's Cloonan, Becky Cloonan.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah,
what a publisher though.
Aftershock. There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, but it's on Comixology. You can pick it up really easy. Good luck trying to find back issues. They're gone. So, you know, they sold out very quickly.
So,
but yeah, We Three would be my definite pick for movie.
Great choice.
So okay. Is that it? We're gonna call that a podcast?
Yeah, we went a lot longer than usual. This was a fertile field to plow. So, no, it's all good, man. It was a good discussion. Thanks to everyone for coming out. Thanks to our loyal listeners. And please do us a solid and mention us on your social media and consider looking at our Patreon to throw us some spare change every month. And we will catch you next. Oh, well, by the way, we've had some questions. We've given away the Books of Magic from the Doctor Strange podcast. So we'll do another giveaway in an upcoming podcast, but that one is finished. So, thanks, everybody, for your time, and we'll see you next time on the BAMF Podcast.